How do you do? The Nighthawks believe it would be a little unkind to present this podcast without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold the story of Life Force, monsters of science who sought to invade Earth in our own image to bring about a reckoning between gods and monsters. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. It also deals very heavily in spoilers. I think this episode will thrill you. It may shock you. It might even horrify you. If you haven't seen the film, it will definitely spoil it for you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now's your chance to, well, we warned you. One thing I am glad. If it was that the Count carried me here and undressed me, he must have been hurried in his task, for my pockets are intact. I'm sure this diary would have been a mystery to him, which he would not have brooked. He would have taken or destroyed it. As I look around this room, although it has been to me so full of fear, it is now a sort of sanctuary, for nothing can be more dreadful than those awful women who are waiting to suck my blood. Dracula by Bram Stoker.
All right, I hit the button. Don't say anything you wouldn't say to Congress.
There's a lot of things I'd like to say to Congress right now. You want to give me a slate?
This is Monstoberfest Ep 1. It's Life Force, more like Death Force. 3, 2, 1.
I like it.
Clap, 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 clap.
I like it.
How much Keef is in this movie?
None.
Aw.
Wait, is Miles O'Keefe in this?
I don't think so. I didn't see him. But you know who is?
Who is?
Picard.
Yes, he is, Sir Patty Stew. How you doing?
Sadly, no dogs.
His first on-screen kiss, if you're watching the right cut of it.
I hate that they Demi Moore'd it, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. What is up, Mr. Trevor? How are you today?
Not much, Mr. Matt. How are you?
I'm all right. We're doing this with the sun upon us because it is Labor Day.
Is it?
In chronology.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We're trying to get ahead of the game because every year it always seems like we're super rushed to bring you. What is the name of that thing we do every year, Matt?
You're trying to set me up so that you can cut out that I said Labor Day.
No.
Are you referring to our annual Monstoberfest Halloween special?
I am talking about Monstoberfest!
This year we're doing something we learn from our own criticism. We like to take a sequel, we like to iterate. And we've done Monstoberfest. We've done The Return of Monstoberfest. We've done Spawn of Monstoberfest. Matt, what are we doing this year?
This year we are jumping the bionic shark and going to Monstoberfest
in space.
We've never tried to harmonize before. I think you were a little sharp.
Yeah, I think so. This year, the horror is invading from the cosmos. We're here for it. We're a proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network family of podcasts. And you can find us on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podomatic, Spotify, most other podcast aggregates. But yeah, this edition is Monstoberfest in Outer Space. And for this particular episode, I guess outer space is invading both literal London and, I'm going to argue, figurative London literature in this movie, Life Force, from Toby Hooper. You would know Toby from his seminal Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the transcendent Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and, of course, the PG-rated horror film that's, I guess, good for the family, Poltergeist.
Poltergeist is... how is it PG?
I don't know. No, I will tell you exactly why. Number one, when it came out, there was no PG-13. And two, it was produced by Steven Spielberg. That's why it's not R.
I guess it really doesn't have any of the things.
No, it's like it's got the worst things in there for anybody watching at home who might want to be watching Poltergeist instead of Life Force. Which I guess I'm not going to judge you for that, but Life Force is a good movie. You could watch Life Force. But anyways, you know, they've got a guy tearing his face off in a hallucination. And then I believe there is that scandalous moment that we've discussed in our 420 episodes where Craig T. Nelson and the mother character share a joint between them, which I do not think would fly in a PG movie now. But yeah, it's really more atmospheric, spooky ghosts and clown dolls.
Poltergeist is a super effective movie, though. Like, it's pretty damn spooky.
It's spooky. It's iconic. We have actually been sitting here scratching our heads, folks. We're pretty sure that there was an episode planned of Poltergeist at some point that obviously didn't get released, but we're almost positive we recorded. So we may have to loop back and visit or revisit, depending on your perspective and what narrative you believe, Poltergeist. But in this edition of the Nighthawks podcast, we're going to be talking about Toby Hooper's Life Force. This is a British sci-fi horror yarn, which is not rated PG. This movie has acres of full frontal female nudity in it. So this one, not good for the whole family.
Well, I will say that it's one person most of the time. Obviously, it's purient. They got a very attractive model to carry the bucket of nudity around, but it is also, like, a lot of it is pretty sterile. It's just kind of an alien walking around without clothes because she doesn't know about clothes.
You know, I was going to say clinical, but I like that word better. It can be titillating if you choose to deploy that, but it doesn't have to be, if that makes sense. I was talking about this in the comments section on Facebook the other day, because when it comes to Life Force, folks, we're hitting this hard and we're hitting this early because compared to a movie made in 2020, Life Force, which was a movie made in 1985, or what I guess made in 84, released in 85, there is a lot of Matilda May in this movie that is a little incongruous with what you might see of a similar actress in a modern film.
The movie's notorious for it. It was kind of... always sort of a, it got mentioned in horror circles a lot, so we're sort of obligated to address it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost a shame because it kind of overshadows what happens later on in the movie. Like this is a much more interesting movie than I remembered it from the first time I watched it.
Agreed. Let's hit a synopsis real quick, but we're going to loop back around to the nudity. In Toby Hooper's Life Force, we're dealing with the members... God, how do you synopsize this? It's members of a British space program. I believe they're accompanied by a commander who is intended to be an American. They're sent on an exploratory mission to observe the tail of Halley's Comet up close for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for both the explorers and the human race as we know it.
And let me tell you what they find. It ain't Marshall Applewhite.
God damn, dude. Yeah, kids, Google that one. But what they discover behind the comet is a ship, and it's an alien ship, and it's found to be occupied by thousands of desiccated bat-winged aliens. And then also within the hold of the ship, we find three gorgeous naked people, two men and a woman, in suspended animation.
From the director of Poltergeist and the writer of Alien comes a terrifying new film.
I'm getting a very small radar cross-section.
150 miles long.
EGR's confirmed.
Tell them we have an artificial object out here.
In the tail of Halley's Comet, there's something wrong. Something ancient. Something evil.
Jesus.
Houston, we have a problem.
Something's happening to me.
Something hungry that's brought to Earth.
She's destroyed worlds.
That girl was no girl. She was totally alien to this planet and our life form. And totally dangerous.
We just found a body in Hyde Park.
Life force.
Close your eyes.
Visited you how?
In my mind.
Let it go!
It's already spreading. You didn't stop it, it's too late.
With me.
Life force. The terror has just begun.
So through various turns of events, the suspended bodies are brought back to Earth, where they awaken and begin giving the human race hell, as they turn out to be a race of... I have been calling them vampires, Matt, but I guess... There might be a little debate over that. I'd say energy vampires or succubi of some kind that feed off the life force of other beings. That's the name of the movie. And what's more, these vampires are psychic. They can project themselves into other bodies. And they also propagate like cockroaches. So it's up to a bunch of stiff upper lips and a handful of British military suits to investigate and try and contain the vampire outbreak and also figure out what the hell they're up against. Just right off the bat, how did life force leave you this time around?
Hot and cold, more hot than cold. I did have the, you just alluded to it, I did have one complaint that they're not saying the V word.
Right.
You know, they'll be damned before they admit this has anything to do with vampires.
Well, and that's why I kind of, like, they don't bite you on the neck and suck out your energy through a pair of holes. They don't have fangs, but they do have that kind of vampiric, rakish sexual quality. Obviously, they're naked. And sexuality and attraction and pheromones and lust all play a part in this.
I'm naked and it's not sexual.
Touche. The way they realize it is it's almost they suck an energy out of you. If you saw maybe Dr. Sleep recently, it's kind of a weird energy version of the steam that they all...
Wait, hold on. Is this how Colin Robinson got here?
He's an energy vampire.
And he does not know how to yo-yo.
This is the second time I saw this all the way through. And I have to admit, Matt, and this is what I was saying when we're going to circle back to the nudity, this was a lot better than I remember it being. Because
yeah, you know, every long-term memory I had of this movie was of the first half hour.
Right.
And I forgot how off the rails and genre bent it gets by the end.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, every memory I have of this movie, and like I said, we were talking about off mic, I think we actually saw this together the first time I watched it in a mutual friend of ours' basement. And every memory I have of it involves naked Matilda May. And somehow, because of that, I have taken the first act and the third act and glued them together. And there's a whole other, like, adventure the characters go on that I had virtually no memory of.
For the record, we don't just gather in basements and watch nudity. Trevor just doesn't know how to say we watched it at a party.
It was a movie night, you know. It was a movie event. You know, we watched a couple of. I think we watched The Bunker that day, and I think we watched maybe The Mangler 2, which was awful.
Oh well, that would explain why our eyes were gouged out.
But the IMDb trivia tracks the total runtime of Matilda May on screen for 7 minutes of screen time, which is shocking. I mean, even on this most recent rewatch where I'm like, actually, she's not on screen a lot of the time. And even though when she is on screen, she's naked for most of it, that all ends by the end of the first act. Like,
well, she's present because her character is telepathic and she does a lot of not vampire-y telepathic summoning and telepathic seducing and dream sequencing. And so her character's presence is flitting from body to body and mind to mind and speaking through other people's mouths. And that blood thing. Yeah.
And so this actually felt to me, Matt, kind of like an old Hammer horror movie, maybe a little Quatermass thrown in there. But I think this is one of the absolute standouts for Canon Films, which is a notorious low-budget film company.
I'm looking at the budget, and I think this is probably one of the more expensive things they ever tried, and I think it bit them in the ass at the time.
It did. Basically, what we're looking at is they dropped a ton of money on this, thinking that this was going to be their big blockbuster. And I think it probably could have been. Like, the practical effects in this are really good. The writing in this is really good. It's based on a novel by Colin Wilson. And the name of that novel is The Space Vampires, he says, looking very unthrilled into the mic. But I guess because Canon Films was so notorious for being a low-budget production house, they didn't want a corny title like The Space Vampires, so they went with Life Force. They wanted this to be their big-budget movie. And so between this, another movie we've discussed on the show before, which was Masters of the Universe, and Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, which were all Canon films, basically broke this studio, and that's why we don't have Canon films anymore.
A note on practical effects, right? I would wager to say probably a full-on 50% of your reaction to this movie is going to be determined by your attitude about practical effects.
Yeah.
Now, the many horror purists think that practical effects look... They have a certain veracity for even though they're I mean, obviously at times plastic or I mean, plastic's not the technical term, but they avoid the uncanny valley because they exist. They have weight and heft and cast shadows.
Right.
And so some horror people are very into them and other horror people are much more forgiving of CGI. The only really scary movie I can think of that had really noticeable CGI is probably actually The Frighteners, which oddly is a horror comedy that just has some really off-putting scenes.
They kind of took it into mask territory, I think. We just weren't quite there yet.
But I think one thing that probably hurt this in the U.S., this is a very, that's that quarter mass. It's very quintessentially British, and it has sort of a mixed... one thing it definitely borrows directly from Dracula is it has an ensemble. It doesn't have a straight-up hero. It has an ensemble sort of... There's the American astronaut, also kind of the Mina Harker, because he's been seduced by the female entity.
I don't know that I caught this the first time I watched it. And it is because I have subsequently not only read Dracula a few times since then, but also we have covered so many Dracula properties on the show. I recognized, there's a lot of Dracula DNA in this story. Matilda May is obviously Dracula. The Churchill, which is the ship that they take behind Halley's Comet, it has a lot of overlap with the Demeter, the boat that Dracula comes to London on.
As sort of does the entity's spacecraft.
Right.
There's a double dose of ghost shipping in here.
And then I think Curl Carlson is both Harker and Mina. He has elements of both. Dr. Fadala is a stand-in for Van Helsing.
I think Dr. Armstrong, who's played by Sir Paddy Stew, is kind of a stand-in for Dr. Seward. He runs a hospital for the mentally ill. It's not a perfect overlap. You're not going to pick scenes out of this and say, here's the analog, and it's just a perfect overlay of Dracula. It's certainly a Dracula remix, especially in the second act. However, this breaks down where Act 1 reminded me of Alien from Ridley Scott. Act 2 reminded me of Dracula from the Bram Stoker novel. And then Act 3 is basically like 28 days later, which of course would not come out until years later. I think this even predates Alien a little bit, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. But
This is the part of the movie I had most forgotten. So second act, it goes real hammer. Like it really does. It goes, I guess we have to move a little more incrementally through the synopsis, right? They bring the three healthy entities back in these glass coffins that they're in that are some kind of suspension pod. Female entity wakes up, it drains the victim and escapes. And then 2 hours later, that victim reanimates with like a secondary lower tier level of the not vampirism. And so his desiccated, mummified body drains another victim and is momentarily restored to health, and they take him and put him in a cell. And he's actually kind of confused and scared. He doesn't even, like, he almost did it involuntarily. And then they realize that they have to watch the new body, and that if it gets up in 2 hours, they have a zombie-type problem. They have a pathogen that's very, very fast-moving that they are going to have to do something about.
But even then, the economy of it is kind of strange, because the vampire, unless it finds another victim, does not hang around long. So that particular guard doesn't last. I think either he dies or it's implied that they only have a short time between having to drain victims, and they eat a lot.
The zombie, the not zombies that the not vampires make, it is implied they have to kill somebody every time their 2 hour clock winds down. And I love that actually the movie addresses this roughly the point I thought of it is you start thinking like, wow, that's a really fast cranking. This is a virus that kills its host. And then the ship that the entities were on turns out to have followed the space shuttle home, and it goes into orbit and it begins collecting the discharged energy when the people finally give out. Although without a lot of exposition, this isn't like super confirmed for us, but the strong implication is that they're a Galactus style threat that drains all the energy from the planet and then leaves as quickly as it can.
It's basically the energy Borg.
Yeah. And so I like that because it's good sci-fi and it neatens the movie up and answers one of those zombie questions, like what are these zombies doing? What's the end game? It seems like it's cooking a little fast and it's not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that aspect. And then the other thing that I have to say for this is the zombie mob scenes of all the drained people running amok are really good zombie scenes.
Well, yeah, and this, you have to understand, this is very in the era of Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. You know, movies that came out post-Romero, Night of the Living Dead. And these are fast-moving, 28 days later, Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead-style hordes. Toby Hooper nicknames them the Walking Shriveled.
Well, and one thing I really liked is like the general scenes of mayhem on the streets have a lot of extras and a lot of like there's a scene where like once the energy drain is commenced, there's a scene where like a tendril of energy goes through a subway station, or I guess I should say underground, whatever.
The tube,
yeah. And it kills like this big snake of blue energy lashes around and kills like 100 people. And it's a really effective scene because there's so many extras. They're all in makeup. All the mayhem on the, they must have actually burned their sets down at the end of the movie because there's a lot of practical fire, practical explosions, like not just the vampire makeup and stuff was practical. They did a lot of stuff the old-fashioned way, and like it looked like a real riot there for a minute. I can assure you that we are recording this in 2020, and we know.
Yes, 2020 still amid the social unrest in the world, and still amid the coronavirus-caused COVID-19 pandemic.
But actually, I'm sorry, I completely got ahead of myself. What I was starting to say is the second act of this is very Hammer horror, because as she goes walkabout and she leaves the complex on foot and gets away from them, she's just traipsing around London and then the countryside for a while, and she takes a victim and disappears, and then we next see her as a different actress. A redheaded hitchhiker is picked up by a guy driving an old classic car through the English countryside, like a very, very woman in white supernatural kind of scenario. And so that's when we're introduced to the idea that the original entity has gone to ground somewhere, and she's reaching out telepathically and moving freely around the environs with just her mind and possessing people to do her bidding.
Yeah, kind of think of Fallen with Denzel Washington.
Then they have an interrogation of that, what was her name, Evelyn, the redheaded woman? They have an odd interrogation scene of her where they do like the James Bond hysterical slap.
Yeah.
And that was definitely something that dated the movie a little. No one has ever calmed down from being slapped.
Yeah.
I don't believe that it works.
I'm the podcast without fear, Luke.
I'm the uncanny Ryan.
I am Kylie the Poodinger.
I am the superior Caitlin.
And I am the agitated Kyle.
And we are most of the Nerd Dome podcast.
Every Friday, some variation of this group gets together and talks about all things nerd.
The newest stuff in TV, movies, comics, video games, and more.
So join us in the Dome every Friday to hear all things nerd.
From a bunch of people who are probably a bit too into it.
Part of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network.
Old man jumping beach, shaving ain't
mine. I'm Nighthawks Oscar czar Cameron Maris.
And I'm Chris Buhite.
And together we're Middle Class Joe, the house band for the Nighthawks podcast.
We wanted to hear more protest music this year, so we decided to record some.
Our new album, In the End You Will Lose, is full of classic songs that we've reworked into protest anthems for the strange place we call America in 2020.
We're talking the gospel according to Woody Guthrie.
All you fascists bound to lose.
R.E.M.
I raise the wall.
I raise the wall.
Now we'll be
Leonard Cohen.
Everybody knows that it's now or never.
Regina Spektor.
And we even recorded some original music to mark the occasion.
Middle Class Joe, 100% independently produced American rock music. Deluxe edition with bonus track, uncensored artwork, and stickers available at middleclassjoe.bandcamp.com. Stream or download now on your favorite service, Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon Music, TikTok, and more.
Hi, I'm Kirk Linger.
And I'm Alan Barber. And we're the hosts of a new podcast called You've Never Heard This?
Each week, Alan and I pick an album that is beloved by one and unfamiliar to the other.
We discuss the album track by track, going into band bios, inspirations for the song, or why the band means so ding-dang much to us.
Join us every Tuesday as we bring you this steamy, musical love stew.
You've Never Heard This is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or basically any other old place you can think of.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do. Let me see your hand.
Beg your pardon.
You're in there, aren't you?
I don't know.
Tell me.
No!
It's gone from her. It's in another body now.
How do you know that?
I can see it. In her mind. She's resisting. I'm gonna have to force her to tell me. Despite appearances, this woman is a masochist. An extreme masochist. She wants me to force the name out of her. She wants me to hurt her. I can see the images in her mind. Do you wanna stay? Otherwise, wait outside!
Not at all. I am a natural voyeur.
Were you in there? Were you there?
Act two of this, where they're running around the countryside trying to figure out which body she's in, is really where this, I think borrows from Dracula the most. It really does feel like, you know, when they're trying to trace the boxes of Earth and figure out where each one of them is, and then it turns out one box got away and they have to take a circuitous route and try and head them off at the pass and get there before they get to Castle Dracula. Like, there's a lot of English countryside and Carpathian countryside and a lot of European travel in the Bram Stoker novel. And that's what this reminded me of. And really, it all kind of takes place in this mental asylum that's run by Sir Patrick Stewart's character. He is not nearly as pivotal a character in this as Dr. Seward is in the Dracula book, but Sir Patrick Stewart's role in this is certainly memorable, and it turns out that the space woman, or space girl is what they call her in the script, but Matilda May's character has been kind of hopping around in this institution from doctor to patient to nurse to orderly to, and it unfolds as they think they've got her nailed down to this one serial killer in a cell. They actually manage to, oh, wait a minute. No, it's actually Patrick Stewart. She's in the doctor.
Yeah, that's actually, I wanted to ask you that. Okay, because this is me questioning my recollection of the movie. Did the serial killer ever do anything, or was their request to go into his cell always just because they had a maid and they wanted to get Patrick Stewart into a cell?
Well, the description that the Colonel gives is very specific. Now, the Colonel is, if there is a protagonist in this, it is our American Colonel. And he, like we said, is kind of half in Mina, half in Harker territory. Steve Railsback plays Colonel Tom Carlson. And he has kind of a psychic link with Space Girl. And in moments of concentration can kind of see things through her point of view. And at one point he describes an inmate at Sir Patrick Stewart's hospital. Now, I do not know if he used that as a gambit and said, I saw through Patrick Stewart's eyes this inmate, and I have put together that Sir Patrick Stewart is the vampire, or if Matilda May was just really making the rounds in that hospital and they just figured out it was Sir Patrick Stewart. I believe the explanation they give is there is a Sir Patrick Stewart touches Steve Railsback at one point, and he says, as soon as he touched me, I realized that that was her.
But there are no overt Sykes, the serial killer, doesn't do a bunch of stuff that I just wasn't.
No, he's just
slipped through my.
No, he's okay. Just he's a red herring.
The killer was red herring. Remember?
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah,
red herring. On the, it's a nostalgic reference for you people.
I think we have discussed ad nauseum, so I'm not going to belabor it. I'm not the biggest fan of Bram Stoker's Dracula as an overall story, and there's a lot of adaptations that I'm not a big fan of. Many of those will surprise you. Some of them I am. Like, for instance, we discussed The Horror of Dracula on the show very early in the podcast. It was the first outing for Sir Christopher Lee in that character. That's one I really enjoyed. Matt, I think this is another one that I'm going to say is a Dracula adaptation that I really enjoyed, because it does away with a lot of the things that I have problematic with Dracula and either addresses them, fixes them, or eliminates them completely. And it's because it's iterative enough. I thought I was getting into Alien, and I got Dracula. And as soon as I'm catching onto Dracula, it goes full Horde movie in the end. And the transition there is almost hilarious. Because they're like, oh, wait, while we've been running around the countryside, her body is still in London. She must have found another victim. What's been going on in London? And then it's literally smash cut to London that is in flames and riots are going on. And they're like, oh, shit.
There's Neil and Vivian smashing windows.
Crucifixion's a really negative way to kill yourself, Rick. There's no way to hammer in the third nail.
I know it's only 50p, but when I loan money, I expect it back.
There's a song to be sung, 'cause we may not be the young ones very long.
For me, It's very strange because Ridley Scott infamously cited cited Texas Chainsaw as being very influential over Alien. And to me, and I can't confirm, I'm not telepathic like a not vampire, but to me, there is a very strong similarity in the first 20 minutes here between this and Alien.
And honestly, I had occasion to watch Alien recently. Because of that, even stylistically, there are moments in this where I'm like, hey, this kind of looks like Alien. Like, this looks like low-budget Alien. And that would not be out of lane for Golan and Globus, who were the big studio execs over at Canon Films. Like, Canon Films was very much a shoot from the hip, let's make some movies that sound like two other movies glued together. Like, their story is actually pretty remarkable and is the subject of a documentary. Going to Golan and Globus and saying, hey, we're gonna make the beginning look like Alien would be a good way to sell them on doing a project like this. And so I'm sure there has to be some kind of tip of the hat there. In and of itself, I believe one of the most notorious elevator pitches in the world was the elevator pitch that Ridley Scott gave for Alien, which was it's Jaws in space. And so, once again, Matt, we all bring it around to episode 2 of the Nighthawks podcast. They're all f***ing shark movies.
Oh, ladies of Spain.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies. So here's the other thing I'm going to say about the nudity. Now that we've had a chance to kind of parse the film.
By the way, how come we can't get a pickle here?
Right?
they can have this girl walking around on her 18th birthday, ass naked for, you know, full on.
Like, they had to put in shadows in post when she was walking up a staircase so they didn't get an X rating. Like, yeah, that's a thing in this movie.
But it's important that the guy entities have frost on their tubes so that you don't accidentally see some twig and berry. And both of these guys look like Sting and Dune in different ways, which is amazing.
Yeah. Well, and there are moments where, like, they're in a glass case, but the toe strap that's holding the case aloft is, you know, covering his area all the time. And then occasionally they'll give Matilda May some modesty. But then in the wide shot, she is absolutely naked. This was something that obviously caught my attention the first time I saw it. It was obviously a big deal. And I think it does feed into the sexuality of vampires. She is very much a lustful, very enchanting, very... You almost get like a Black Widow vibe from her. But still, she didn't need to be naked the whole 7 minutes of her run, you know?
They make it really clear that they're like seductive entities. Like, even the guy, the plain red shirt guard guy that gets drained and reanimated, in the short time he's awake, he uses his mind power, his brand new mind powers on the pathologist that's autopsying him.
Right.
So it is thematically correct, and it is not truly gratuitous in the literal sense. But I have a pet theory that they did it to counteract how Victorian the first and second act were. They're like, what's missing from this Hammer formula that is dropped off for us? Overt sex. And so maybe they thought that was the little canon chocolate that could go in the Hammer peanut butter and make them something that would get a, you know, because there's not a lot in the first. This is a little talky and slow in the first 20 for like a junior high horror kid.
The first 20 is the space stuff, which is very operatic, and there's not a lot of dialogue. The score here by Henry Mancini, it was Mancini. Mancini took over for Horner, right?
Yeah, and then they brought in, she brought in a third name, Common, Michael Common.
Oh, not Common the rapper.
No. They brought in Michael Common, to do some final localization for some of the, I guess some of the parts where the end game of the movie was thought to be a little too unscored for the American audience. Apparently we can't do anything without a violin to tell us when to jump.
Well, and it is important to note that there are two different cuts of this movie circulating. We picked up one that was readily available as of this record. It was on HBO Max. But that's the U.S. theatrical cut. There is a U.K. cut, which I also believe is Toby Hooper's preferred cut, that is longer, and there's a couple of additional scenes, but really it's more of just kind of a retooled take. And there are some things, Matt and I actually read down a list from Brian Collins, film critic Brian Collins, who kind of detailed the differences between the two. And there's a couple things in there I kind of wish they would have left in.
Well, yeah, like, and actually that brings me to another thing I like about this movie is obviously it's not perfect because it's still a movie and not a lecture, but this is sort of an anti-Prometheus in that the science is pretty good for most of it. especially the space stuff. They like, you know, they leave their helmets on and when they first get the not vampires to Earth, they do actually quarantine them in an actual quarantine, and people wear like masks when they go in to see them.
During a quarantine, they're wearing masks, you said?
Yeah, apparently masks are important for actually quarantining.
Huh.
The people in Prometheus don't seem to understand.
Well, and you know, and that's, I think Prometheus just, that's why people just don't like it.
That's why it seemed like the whole time in Prometheus, they couldn't really contain the infection and they kept prolonging the trauma they were dealing with.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's one bad move after the other. And then pretty soon there's this monster out you can't put back in the bottle. But
In Prometheus, it ended up changing all of civilization. In Prometheus, the space movie that is part of our space movie discussion.
Right.
And in no way subtextual.
Of course, however, the subtext that isn't here does not break down when we also point out that things don't work out so great in Life Force either.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what you're mentioning. Yeah, there's an actual cut here that makes that a problem.
Yeah, what they cut is that, so the first time we see the vampires, they're in the quarantine room. Ms. Vampire gets out. Then when the two male vampires sit up, the two security guys on duty just waste them with, like, grenades. they're just like, nope. And then the other thing I like about this in terms of like the scientific overkill is when the British the RAF guy that's in charge, who is sort of the actual, sort of sharing the hero shine with the American astronaut.
Yeah.
Their names are Kane is the RAF guy.
That's Peter Firth, yeah.
Yeah, and but he looks at the dead aliens and he goes, yeah, take those pieces and lock them up and put a guy watching them too. And I like that because he's a good man and thorough, you know? I'm just going British to British with no mind for how they relate.
Well, and it is important to note that part of what happens that gets Space Girl, I hate to call her Matilda May, because Matilda May is a, you know, fully self-realized functioning human adult in the world currently, and this is a character she played, but the character's name is Space Girl, and I'm sorry, but I'm so glad they never actually said it out loud, because that's dumb, but her character is released because the guy is kind of pervin' on her. Now, one could argue that she... I think the name of the vampire power is glamour. She may be compelling him to do that, but that's what Dracula is. It's this cautionary tale about lust and sex. And that's kind of what breaks quarantine, is the dude's looking at this pretty naked girl.
Is it, or is it the initial stirrings of anti-monarchy sentiment in Victorian Europe?
My God.
I'm just going to say,
my God.
A lot of vampires died in the revolution, man.
You're right.
Robespierre got more vampires by chance than Van Helsing ever did on purpose. Snick, snick.
What do you want from me?
I love you.
human. So perfect. What are the bird creatures on the ship?
Our bodies are unimportant. As you and your men have approached in your ship, we changed them
for you.
We entered your minds and found their new bodies. I took my shape from your mind. I took your language. I became the woman I found there in your deepest thoughts, your deepest needs. I am the feminine in your mind, Carlson.
Where are you? Where's your body? Let me go! Let me go! Let me go! Let me go!
Touch me, Carlson.
Let me go! Let me go! Let me go!
Well, one of the other things that got cut for the American release of this is some of the homosexual content. Specifically, that at one point, the naked Matilda May, you were actually slighted a naked Matilda May stealing the energy from another woman, implying that she can seduce women. And it's tiptoed around that one of the other vampire survivors, that there was some male-on-male glamour going on.
Yeah, the scene in the asylum.
And then the scene in the asylum.
They do a ghost, and at the last minute, when the colonel is about to kiss Patrick Stewart, and at the last minute, they do a symbolic swap out and put Matilda May in there.
And what actually happened in the British cut is they've got Sir Patrick Stewart, like, strapped down to the table. They're pumping his character full of drugs, trying to keep Matilda May's character. They're trying to keep Space Girl's consciousness inside a catatonic Dr. Armstrong, who's Patrick Stewart's character. Because she's in there and because she is psychically linked with Tom Carlson, they start having this conversation about how she chose this form because that's his ideal woman, and that she loves him, and that they can make this work, and they're getting closer and closer. You can cut the sexual tension with a knife. However, we do continually cut between having Matilda May naked on the table and having Sir Patrick Stewart screaming and sweating. Well, and in the British cut, when he goes in to kiss Matilda May, they swap it out, and he is kissing Patrick Stewart, which was Patrick Stewart's first on-screen kiss. Now, for the politics of 1985, I guess that just wouldn't fly in the U.S.
It does actually bring us to another interesting point about the movie, the old Is This Lovecraftian? Because
right.
Several times, that scene and a few other times in the movie, she implies that she actually does want to elevate him in some way and take him with her. When she goes. And then they also, part of what actually happens in the wrap up, but we'll get to that. But then they also ultimately discover a method of permanently killing the creatures that is a throwback, a use of a cold iron weapon, lead and iron. The variant on the myth is it's not dead in the heart, but in the energy cluster where the creature actually is in the body, which is actually just below the heart, we're informed. And so there's an implication there, together with their presence on Halley's Comet, that sort of like the Predator, these things have come and gone.
And have worked themselves into human mythology, basically.
And then the closest thing we're shown to their true form is very, very reminiscent of the bat-winged sort of open vampire that we see in 30 Days of Night or Fright Night or the... you know, certain scenes in Dracula, the anthropomorphic bat-winged devil. So we get a sense they're tied in with human mythology, and they also select as their final hideout, like a cathedral. So there's some definite horror imagery that didn't have to be there strictly for the story. They could have been in any large building, you know. So there's some tie-in with mythology that I thought actually worked here. Sometimes it's a corny device, like in the Dwayne Johnson Doom movie.
Well, and it's not just a cathedral, though. It is the British National Cathedral. So not only are they able to evoke that kind of gothic church, like, you know, that medieval imagery It is also a very iconic location for the people who would have been watching this in the UK. That's tantamount to when the alien ships in Independence Day, speaking of another horror from the stars, when they blew up the White House, that blew our minds in 97. We'd never seen that before. It's like, holy, the bad guys won, and the movie's about revenge, you know? That was a moment for young 16-year-old Trevor.
Nobody writes viruses for Max except for aliens.
So, Matt, that brings me to the end here. What is your interpretation of the ending?
I think they got away.
Yeah?
I mean, I think they... So what happens in the end is Kane confronts the Van Helsing analog, the Dr. Faluda.
Yeah.
He takes the ancient cold iron blade and he goes and he kills the last remaining... Faluda has killed one of the male vampires but been infected himself in the process. And Kane exchanges final words and final gunshots with him, and then his life force is sucked up into the atmosphere. And Kane proceeds to the cathedral with the blade. On the steps, he confronts and stakes the remaining male vampire. And then he heads in to do battle with the evil enchantress, and he finds he's too late, and she's already in a kind of impenetrable column of light, consummating her seduction of the colonel. And so there's this whole Tetsuo Kaneda moment where Kane throws him the blade and he has to sort of do seppuku on himself and her, and he and Jensen runs both of them through, and her eyes widen in shock, and then we see them both sucked into orbit, but we do not see their, you know, in Marvel terms, they're not definitively dead. We don't see their bodies burst into ash like the other creatures did, and we don't see them dead. We do see the ship in orbit recoils and seems to suffer some damage, and it folds up its solar sails and heads back out into space.
But this is after it has basically sucked the whole of London dry of their souls.
Yeah, so my interpretation is that they successfully interrupted the incident, they successfully interrupted this cycle, but they did not kill off the creatures, and they will probably be back.
Yeah, and so basically what we have here is a creature that is so volatile that they will go through their food source before they can propagate in any kind of meaningful way. And so what the ship is it's a giant support system to hold them in stasis while they just make their way from planet to planet, storing up and rejuvenating these creatures. Now, early in the movie, we see that there's been some sort of incident on the ship where it's only the three vampires that are left, and then the rest of them are kind of desiccated out floating in the hold. But I do have to say, zero-G bat creatures was a creepy visual image and was pretty well realized.
Oh, yeah. That part is very, very apocalyptic, very, very Lovecraftian, in my opinion. I was oddly surprised how good the latter zombie stuff in the end was, and I was actually quite taken with it, because like it had real fire, it had those guys doing that firewalks. You know?
Yeah,
I swear to God, Butthead, if you change that channel, this could be the coolest day of our lives. But yeah, it had firewalks, it had practical explosions, it had things falling apart, it had cars tipping over, like it was a good old-fashioned practical disaster movie in there too. And I was actually kind of like, I'm not going to say I was surprised it was good because I knew it reputationally, but I had a pleasant a watching experience because I was amazed how unrepresentative my memory of this movie was.
Yeah, guilty.
Did that make sense?
Yeah, no, it's 100% because I honestly remembered this as the Naked Chick movie. Like, I have to call myself on that, and that's all I remembered. And it's apparently 7 minutes of screen time. That was one of the notes that I took, was she is not naked on screen nearly as much as I thought she was. Although she is on screen and naked a lot. But
I think part of it is that when she is, she's searingly so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like it's pretty blatant, you know.
Well, and I think at the end of the day, what I have to say about that is none of that was particularly necessary. I think all of that could have been conveyed if she was just wearing a sexy space suit, or Like, Matilda May from the neck up is still a gorgeous woman and could probably still pull those seductive moves. But I think she was selected specifically because she was willing to do the nudity, and this was important for Toby for some reason. But honestly, I think what this movie gains by having that in there, I think it has cost it in the zeitgeist, because that's what people focus on, you know?
I think there is a legitimate rationale for it, in that it does make the entity seem very clinical, because it is immodest and she does do a, like, her physical portrayal of it is neither modest nor brazen. She really does seem like just unaware that she's supposed to wear clothes. So I think on that level, like, it worked pretty well for selling the idea that this is an alien, you know. And so I think it was operant and thus not purely gratuitous and only gratuitous, but it was a little it's not strictly necessary.
Cheesecake is cheesecake. Like, yeah. At the end of the day, you know, you just got to call it what it is.
And I have to say that I think they might have envisioned some advertising value to it once they started to see it. They were like, oh, we can get away with this. We can have this exploitative element and it will be good for the movie. And I'm not sure that's borne out over time. Now, when we were kids, this was one of those tags in the video store that you did want to pull.
Yeah.
Like, it was notorious for having boobs in it. I'm sick of saying nudity.
Well, it's got everything in it except sausage and eggs.
I'm almost embarrassed for the movie being stuck with the rep off it at this point.
Right. Yeah, that's really where I want to go, is the element that I keyed into this time, and maybe it's because I have watched more movies, I'm a more mature movie viewer. The things that I was keying to this time was the old Hammer horror stuff, the old Quatermass stuff. This was scratching that itch that I didn't even realize I had. And I'm like, oh man, this is hitting the spot. Like, this is like digging into an old soup recipe you haven't had in years, and then it hits you, and then all of those memories come back. I'm thinking of old Christopher Lee movies. I'm thinking of the Phantom of the Opera from Hammer Horror, with it instantly was conjuring of that. But then also the practical effects in this, the walking shriveled in this, are just so, to me, I think they're super well realized. I think they're up there with, remember when they're quizzing, or they're interrogating the desiccated half corpse on Return of the Living Dead? It's kind of on that level, where it's like, you wonder if there's an actor under there, and if they are they healthy, you know?
I don't think there's enough pulpy adventure movie. I want my Brendan Fraser mummy. I want a hit of that Rocketeer, you know? So I'm a sucker for anything that does that kind of adventures in the realm of dark magic and darker science. So it hit that spot for me as well.
Well, and like you said, it did hit that Lovecraftian spot too. I think I started to say and never finished. We were talking about Alien, and I don't know if this is just a commonality with this type of story, but if you look at Alien, Prometheus, which are obviously in a franchise, but then you get At the Mountains of Madness, this movie, like, there's a lot of overlap where you're a human archaeologist discovering a technologically ascendant race who actually predate us by several thousand years, and it's all kind of smacks of that At the Mountains of Madness, The Thing territory. So that's here too, and that's scratching an itch that I've had for a while, especially now that a lot of people are talking about Lovecraft Country on HBO.
Speaking of which, this week's episode of that is very Indiana Jonesy.
Well, it would be if you listened to this when we recorded it, but since it's October, we're discussing episode four.
It's episode four. I was talking about episode four of the excellent, superb Lovecraft Country that you should watch if you care about things.
Well, since we're there, Matt, why don't we do a little if-then? Do you have anything?
Clearly, I'm going to take them both off the table. I'm going to say,
son of a bitch,
Alien, some adaption of Dracula of your choosing, Night of the Living Dead, are all clear influences here. Beyond those, I would say,
per if-then, I think we've dropped a lot of helpful ones. I think the Quatermass movies from the 50s, those are old Hammer films. would be pretty good. Or The Thing from Another World, which is, of course, the basis for John Carpenter's The Thing, one of the greatest non-Lovecraft movies out there. Toby Hooper's works, specifically Poltergeist, would be a good fit after this, I think. And I would also recommend, maybe on a different night for different reasons, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre certainly has its value. However, I think if you were to put them up one to the other, my favorite of those two is the other Canon Films release from Toby Hooper, which is Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, which is a little more tongue-in-cheek, a little more played for camp. It is the Evil Dead 2 to Texas Chainsaw Massacre's Evil Dead. So I check either of those out. Toby Hooper is just a great filmmaker. It's really sad that this is kind of his career kind of tanked between this and Invaders from Mars, which was a remake that he also did. He didn't have a lot of work after that. You can still find some good Toby Hooper content out there. It exists. He
did a lot of TV, and he did some anthology. Like, he did a couple good Masters of Horror.
Yeah. You know, he is unfortunately no longer with us, but I'd check out basically anything from his catalog. On top of that, any of the Hammer Horror, you said, you know, pick the Dracula of your choice. I'm going to actually specifically say Horror of Dracula, which is just, it is my favorite Dracula. I think was a particularly good one, and I think you could listen to any of our given Dracula episodes, which includes The Horror of Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1993 that we did for Monstoberfest last year, and then we also had some little Dracula content in our monster mashup from the very first Monstoberfest and the very first episode where we talk about Waxwork and Monster Squad. Now that movie, by the way, Matt, contains Dracula, and it contains how much Keefe?
Miles O'Keefe?
Miles O'Keefe in Waxwork. I can't let that joke not have a good conclusion, man. we owe it to the Misties out there that we can't leave that one hanging.
That joke should be deployed with every possible chance.
And it should also be archived within the house, within the volumes of the Library of Congress. I think it is definitely one of the greats. Well, Matt, anything else you have to add before we tell people that we are on Facebook, Twitter, and you can find us on all sorts of podcast aggregates like Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. It would have been really funny if you did actually have some stuff, and then we went on for another 5 minutes, and then I had to re-tag with the fact that we are on all those platforms, but...
Well, I've never made you do that before.
I'm just saying it was awful presumptuous of me to throw that in there without actually knowing if you had anything else. So I'm glad you didn't, but I won't step on you again like that. That was rude of me.
I have some thoughts on Derrida.
Well, folks, stay tuned. More Monstoberfest in space is coming at you this month. We're going to have a lot of fun with this one. Stay tuned for that. Stay tuned to the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network and our family of podcasts with great content from shows like Rebootleggers and Geek Parenting, Petticoat Lane, just a cavalcade of podcasts that you can enjoy. And also, find Matt and I. We have been contributing lately to oneofus.net's Screener Squad, where if, you know, here on Nighthawks, we do the long, granular, gristy takes on movies. You know, we sit here and we can talk for an hour about Life Force. But on Screener Squad, that is mostly new films, and it's really our hot take. It's more of a traditional film critic role that we're helping with out there. So Matt and I have been invited onto a handful of panels. We've got some great critics over there. Matt, how's that treating you? Are you enjoying your time over with Screener Squad?
Yeah, I like getting to just run my mouth.
It's nice. We have kind of a policy on the show, and it's never been a hard and fast policy. Obviously, we have reviewed a few movies that we didn't particularly care for in the wash. But our general rule is we have to have at least something good to say about a film. And sometimes we don't have that option on Screener Squad. So it's been kind of nice to be able to talk about movies that maybe are threes on the scale, you know? A few middling films, a few films that we may not have necessarily talked about before. And sometimes it's just good to get cranky and kind of bag on one.
Yeah, I think that is a fair depiction.
I'm telling you, a few weeks ago, I did the Class Action Park documentary. That was such a disappointment. I was so sad.
Yeah, you were sad. I remember your sadness.
Matt, do you want to send us out to space?
Sure. Everybody, it's time to hit stop and go to bed because it's almost space morning. Now we're reaching.
We should do an episode on the Young Ones.
Well, we did that one that got lost on Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah, we should revisit Drop Dead Fred too. And Little Monsters. That was a double feature.
I liked that episode. I liked that talk. That was good talk.
That was a good talk. We should do that again.
This is a Hello Sweetie Podcast Network production.